This talk was recorded by Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. For more talks and information, visit www.imsb.org.
So this talk, freeing ourselves from the eight worldly dharmas, is part of the fundamental teachings. But actually, one of the reasons I chose this topic is it is a fundamental list. It's one of the lists from the suttas that the Buddha talks about as a teaching list, a way of looking at life, looking at different aspects of life so that we can find more freedom. But it's not taught as commonly in the Theravada tradition. It's very common in the Tibetan tradition. I'm curious how many people, many of you may be familiar with this, but how many people are familiar with the teachings of the eight worldly, sometimes eight worldly dharmas, eight worldly winds, eight worldly conditions, there's different titles. How many people familiar with it? A few of you. I actually went on to Dharma Seed today, which is the website of a million Dharma talks, and to see what was on there. And I'd say about eight or nine came up, which is not very many, on this topic. I'm sure it's included in other talks, but talks devoted to this. And almost half of them are by one person, one teacher. So I think it's a list I like a lot. I think it's a very useful list, and that's why I want to talk about it tonight. It's particularly useful in daily life. It's all about daily life. It's all about our everyday experience. It's all about today. It's all about tonight. It's all about how we go through our life. Sometimes I like to call it instead of the eight worldly conditions, the eight obsessions of the ego self. And these eight obsessions of the ego self, which I'll say more about, are actually I call them obsessions because they're very seductive, very compelling, and our culture is completely itself obsessed with these. And it's very hard to, in daily life, escape all the conditioning that we've had for our entire life to be completely devoted, you might say, to these eight worldly dharmas. And I will shortly say what they are. The Buddha said that, the world turns on these eight conditions. The world turns on these eight conditions. And really what he means is that they are the sort of the forces of conditioning that keep the conventional world of suffering really going throughout the world, and you'll see they're very familiar. They are the conditions, you might say they're the plot line of all our storylines. They're the plot line, the stories that really keep us distracted and lost a lot of the time in our life, that keep us caught on the gerbil wheel of life, and that keep us looking out there for answers, for solutions, for happiness, for freedom, instead of looking in here where they will be found. As many of you, I'm on some different, you know, daily lists that pop up in my email. This quote, that quote of the day. And sometimes I sort of like to take them as messages. So one of mine today was a quote by Wei Wu Wei, who you may not be familiar with. He was actually an early 19th century British man who was an interesting teacher of Eastern practice and religion. And the quote was, "The aim of all religions is recovery of our true nature by awakening from the living dream." So waking up from the pull and the illusion of the eight worldly conditions is actually a large part of our practice. Particularly, we're not monastics here, and even the eight worldly conditions still apply to monastics. But as we're more inundated and overwhelmed by these conditions. And actually, I just heard a story recently where Milarepa, who's a famous Tibetan practitioner, teacher, saint from, I don't know, like 12th century or something like that, who lived in caves in the mountains, wrote that he went to the caves and still the eight worldly dharmas came with him. So what are they? They're a set of four pairs. So I kind of think them, there's the good column and the bad column. And these four pairs of experience are extremely familiar to us. And their very familiarity means that they need to be sensitively, thoroughly, deeply investigated, known, and identified again and again and again in our life. So the first pair I have here is the pair of praise and blame. And when I say a good side and a bad side, I don't mean one side is preferable and one side is what we want and one side is what we don't want to like cultivate in spiritual practice. I mean that one side, both sides we get hooked into, we get caught by. And one is a positive experience we get hooked by, and one is what we might call a negative experience. So praise and blame or criticism. Is that familiar? So praise, meaning that we can get hooked by the need, the drive, the attachment to being praised. We all like being praised, I think. Sometimes it's uncomfortable, but we like people to say nice things about us. We like to hear that, you know, what we've done or accomplished or created has people have appreciated or liked. And we pretty universally don't like to be criticized or blamed. You know, we might be blamed for something. It's our fault that something happened. We might be criticized for something we've said, criticized for something we've created. You know, being a teacher, and where I'm in this position of having groups stare at me and on a regular basis, feels like a tremendous invitation for praise and blame. And you get both on a regular basis. And it's an incredible lesson in learning to not be too attached to either one. The next pair is gain and loss. And again, this means gain of things we want and loss of things we want. So, again, this is something we're familiar with every day. Certainly in this economy, we're familiar with it. I don't know how many of you have experienced economic gains and losses, jobs, losses and gains, different, all kinds of situations. A friend of mine recently, or at least she thought she was much more financially responsible than, say, me, and she did all the right things with her money. She retired a few years ago. She had her life savings. And I don't know if you read recently, there was a big Ponzi scheme in Santa Cruz, and she lost her entire life savings. The losses come unexpected, unbidden. It's part of life. And of course, we lose friends, we lose loved ones through circumstance, through illness, through death, through moving, through all kinds of situations. And then another pair is the pleasure-pain pair. And, of course, this is all familiar to us. Pleasure of the senses, of the body, pleasures of circumstances, pain of the body, pain of our emotions. All kinds of situations bring up both of these. And then the last one is actually translated in a variety of ways, all of which are relevant. A more traditional one is fame and disgrace. Since we have such a celebrity culture, that fame is probably much more of an attachment, I think, today than 2,600 years ago, when there wasn't blogs and all kinds of ways you could become famous very quickly. Other translations would be recognition versus disrepute, and then sometimes success and failure. So, of course, the point you might be getting of these pairs is that we can run into trouble on either side of these. Either side becoming too driven towards or away from, either side of this column, the good column, the one we want, the bad column, the one we avoid, are places where we can fall into great suffering and difficulty and confusion. And our life can be a striving, an obsession towards receiving praise, gaining more, having more pleasure, more recognition, avoiding criticism, avoiding loss, avoiding pain, avoiding shame and disgrace and failure. And the basic teaching is, I'll say I have a lot more to say, but the basic teaching is over and over again that these are the inevitable gifts of life. These are inevitable. We all have all eight of these all the time. They're coming and going, they're fleeting, they're here today, they're gone tomorrow. And with all our striving, we can't hold on to the positive ones. With all our striving, we can't avoid the negative ones. And that there is a possibility of actually allowing these winds to come and go without being blown over by them, without getting lost and confused by them. And that's called equanimity. So looking into the eight worldly dharmas or conditions or winds is really a teaching about equanimity, which is the foundation, one of the great fruits of practice. And these eight worldly conditions show us what pulls us out of equanimity often over and over again. One of the definitions I found of equanimity, which I like very much, was unshakable balance rooted in insight. Unshakable balance rooted in insight. And this insight means we need to investigate our habits of being caught up in the eight worldly winds, the eight worldly conditions. We have to understand what they are. We have to understand the nature of human reality, that these things come and go and come and go. How about today? Were you praised today for something? Were you criticized today for something? Were you thrown off balance by that in some way? Did you gain something today? Did you lose something today? Were you thrown off balance by that? I was also reading that the word upekkha, which is the Pali word for equanimity, usually translated as equanimity, is actually a little bit more accurately translated as balance. You might think of it as middle way. And as I was reflecting on it, I thought of, I've studied Tai Chi for many years. And many of you may have done that as well, or some qigong. And at least in my way I was taught Tai Chi was really about learning that rooted balance, of really learning what energetically in the body, in the heart, in mind, it means to be fully rooted. And to be able to respond with actually a kind of ease of heart no matter what comes at you. And this literally means somebody coming to attack you. And so it's learning about a very real ability to meet the forces of life with a energetic, physical, and sense of awareness of balance, of equanimity. And we also need to learn to bring that same equanimity to what arises in our own hearts and minds. Our fears, our reactions, strong emotions. Otherwise, we're continually slung around, we're continually slapped down, we're continually beat up, we're continually pulled by our nose by the events and circumstances of life because of our own misunderstanding, our limited understanding, our perhaps limited insight and awareness, because of our ego self obsession on going after, grasping on one hand and pushing away on the other hand. The eight worldly dharmas are also a way, another way, which I'm already kind of saying here, of understanding and seeing the fundamental reactivity patterns that the Buddha talks about that are the cause of suffering. It's a possibility to see the fundamental, our fundamental suffering in action day after day. Another way to put it is, I've been thinking about how we get, humans tend to get caught up in our dramas. I saw recently a Dharma friend send this somewhere. Maybe it was on Facebook, I don't know. Dharma friend sent is this little, it's like a card, and it said, "Dear Drama, I'm breaking up with you. Signed, Awareness." And these eight worldly winds are the kind of the food of our drama. And here I'm not talking about drama in terms of, you know, theater or whatever, but kind of drama in the sense of our each of our own personal drama queenness. How we get caught up, how we exaggerate, how we are lost in the ups and downs, how we're identified with it, how we it becomes the sole interest in our life, instead of actually dropping into awareness, into something deeper, of creating, of finding this equanimity that has a bigger perspective. So we tend to want to maintain and keep our own dramas in a way that often isn't helpful for us. Our personal stories about how good we are, how bad we are, how successful we are, how much failures we are. And that really keeps us from discovering our true nature. It keeps us in the living dream and the trance that human race is primarily lost in and has been lost in. It keeps us from looking inward and finding that profound potential for peace, for love, for freedom. And these eight worldly dharmas also are, in many ways, the criteria for our identity, how we create an identity, how we've been praised or criticized. A lifetime of being praised and criticized in various ways has often created a certain self-image and an identity that we have. The things that we've gained and lost, the kind of recognition or disgrace or shame that we experience has created a rather often elaborate and thorough identity and sense of self that is actually inaccurate and self-constructed. The ego self, really, what I'm calling the ego self, the small self, the kind of conditioned self, is really only concerned with its only purpose is, in a way, to be concerned with safety, security, identity, and it seeks it over and over again through what has happened in the world, how it sees itself in relationship to the world. And it doesn't have the ability to understand itself in a bigger way, understand itself outside of all the drama and all the storylines. And our self-worth becomes completely dependent upon, is on the line with our praise and our blame. I'll be okay if I get this. I'll be okay if I'm seen this way. I'll be okay if I have approval. I'm not okay. It's a disaster if I'm criticized, if I lose something, if I have this experience of pain or failure. Yes? The world sound like the regular world? Sounds like the newspaper? Sounds like TV shows? I would also say the eight worldly winds reveal what we actually take refuge in. There's this term of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which means taking refuge in our deepest, truest nature, taking refuge in the teachings that help us discover freedom, taking refuge in others that can help us along the way. But if we really look at it, often we're taking refuge in our habits, in our addictions, in our neuroses, and in the eight worldly dharmas. We take refuge in trying to get praise and avoid blame. We take refuge in pleasure and avoiding pain. We take refuge in trying to accumulate success and avoid failure. And these, over and over again, you will hear, are superficial, are out of our control for the most part, are just part of being human. They come and go, they're fleeting, and they are not where you will find happiness, true happiness. And you might also notice that they show up in our spiritual practice, that people are acting out the eight worldly dharmas through their meditation, feeling good about your practice when you've been praised in some way, not feeling good about it when you feel criticized or unseen or whatever. Feeling good about your practice where you feel like you've gained some concentration, feeling bad where you feel like you lost some concentration. Feeling good about your practice when it includes a lot of pleasure and bliss and good feelings. Feeling bad about it when it's difficult or a struggle. So we bring this into how we see everything often, and we are lost in, we lose the actual deep search, the deep longing, the deep possibility of another way. We don't see that we can actually be released from these drives and these impulses, from these fears, from the underlying self-loathing that's often there, from the needing approval that drives many of these. And we begin to see more clearly the mistaken view that has created them. As I was reflecting on it too, it's, you know, one of the teachings of this, which I've already kind of said, but I'm going to repeat, is that these winds don't stop. It's not like stopping the winds. Like if I can stop these conditions from happening, then I'll be free. We cannot stop them. They are part of the cycle of life that come and go. Pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain. One day praise, one day criticism. One day we gain, one day we lose something. And I used to be, I haven't done a long time, but I used to be a sailor. This begs a metaphor for sailing. I used to be a sailor on the Atlantic before I moved down here. And on the water, the wind is your friend, the wind is your enemy. And it depends on your wisdom and your understanding and your awareness of what you're doing. So the wind can capsize you, which is what happens when either the wind of the positive or negative take us over. But if you become more sensitive, if you investigate, if you really look into these, if you, in a sense, you know, understand the weather and the weather patterns, if you can see how the wind moves on the water before it actually gets to you, if you understand how the wind works over a long fetch, if you know how to maneuver your inner sails, then actually it becomes energy and insight and wisdom for your life. But without investigation and without this understanding, we'll be knocked over again and again. I'm guessing, I don't know most of you here, and I'm guessing that you, because you're here, that you have seen through some of these worldly dharmas, some of these conditions, and that you're seeking another way and that you have some wisdom in understanding the third possibility, the possibility of allowing them without being caught by them. And my experience from teaching and watching myself, there's very subtle ways these continue to play out in our life. So I want to ask you a few things. And I actually want a couple quick answers. These are kind of obvious answers, I think. I don't know. But I actually want literal somebody to give me an answer. There's not one answer to any of these, but... So if you are driven, if you are attached to the need to get praise, to be praised all the time, what might be a consequence of that? Just one or two. What might be a consequence? Inflate your ego, yeah. That's certainly one.
Suffering.
You suffer.
You compromise your values.
You compromise your values, yeah. Okay. Now, if you feel driven, attached to the need, if you're totally engaged and it fills up your mind and your energy and your direction with avoiding blame and criticism, what might be the consequence of that? Fear? What else?
Isolation.
Isolation? Yeah. Paralysis? Yeah, certainly limit your life in different ways. And I don't expect that everybody is totally, you know, caught up in any of these, but most of us have moments or times when these are driving our life, right? How about if you're driven, if you're attached to, if a main focus in your life is to get pleasure, to feel pleasure, then you might end up at the AA meeting over there. So what might be another consequence? Right, never enough. Yeah, what else? Fail to do the important stuff, yeah. Get blinded. Again, this is stuff we all know, but I don't think it can be underestimated to remind us, because it works in such insidious ways, because the conditioning is overwhelming in culture. Okay, so if we're driven to avoid pain, if it becomes, again, a main worldview, a sense of your purpose in life, is to avoid pain. What's the consequence of that?
Isolation.
Isolation. You might, you know, not want to do a lot of things.
Addiction.
Addiction, yeah. You might, in this isolation, you might want to avoid emotional pain so you don't connect, aren't with others. And, okay, if you're driven and attached toward fame, recognition, success, if that becomes your main goal in life, again, what might be the consequence of that? And this one, you know, maybe it's success at meditation. Maybe you are driven to enlightenment in a way that might not be that healthy. So what might be the consequence? Put down other people. Yes, maybe use other people to exploit other people. What else? Workaholism. Mm-hmm. Maybe neglecting people and things for that. And I would say you're headed towards probably some disappointment when you don't get success, or when you realize it's, you know, didn't quite have what. The success, the good feelings of it don't last. Okay, again, driven to avoid failure, disgrace, shame. Not risking much. Yeah. Not living in the moment. Yeah, all of these are a lot of not living in the moment. Right. And then the last two are gain and loss. And I think, you have similar answers for those. So I think, again, you can see how all of these block our vision. And I'm wondering right in this moment, do you see which one of these you get hooked by? You're more likely to get caught by and hooked by. Anybody willing to confess? Yes, I see a hand, yeah? Fear of loss, trying to avoid loss? Yes. Right, and what you're alluding to is, I would say, a more nuanced exploration of these, which is nice in the sense that, and one thing I would say, what you're pointing at is another point here. It doesn't mean all of this equanimity. I mean, this is a whole another talk in itself. But this finding this equanimity does not mean that we don't have strong feelings or passions. It really means we're not debilitated by it. We're not hooked into it. We're not crushed by it. We haven't lost our deepest values. We haven't lost what's most important. Matter of fact, when we come back to that, then there is, I would say, a more appropriate response of compassion and caring for what is happening. So what you're saying, you know, it may or may not be a problem. I can't tell from what you're saying. Just because you have strong feelings or sadness about loss of species or loss of a dear friend doesn't mean there's actually an imbalance there. The imbalance comes from when our own sense of ourself, when our own our fears take over, when there's those kinds of reactions that happen that kind of get in the way of the purity of the experience. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anybody else want to mention where you get caught? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. We see how much we've built our sense of self-worth on receiving that. And that goes, you know, I think the praise and blame pair are the most personal and the most, in a way, and the most common, almost everyday events that we can find ourselves being caught a little bit. Yeah. Yeah, I saw a hand over here. Yeah. Well, could you say more what you mean by vulnerability? Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that, again, could be, the fear of pain, the fear of loss. And, of course, pain and loss are part of our experience. That's the point. But what does it mean to meet that, again, with wisdom and openness and understanding? It's not that you like it and seek it out or whatever, but how much are we kind of overwhelmed by it or don't understand it or driven to behave differently because, you know, it's there. Yeah. I saw another hand. So some of that, again, may be the fear of the pain or the discomfort of that. Yeah. And so that might be feeling, in a sense, criticized, in a sense, not seen, or it's fun to kind of tease apart a little bit. So, anybody else? I want to go on to another little short reflection. So I want to ask you, what might it feel like? So let's take praise and blame. Praise and blame, or praise and criticism, can something we get every day, maybe? Well, maybe not every day, but frequently. What would it be like? What's the possibility here to stand that quote I gave you earlier, unshakable balance rooted in insight? Again, what might it be like to be able to stand, you might say, in the middle of that, in the middle of receiving praise, in the middle of receiving blame or criticism, and stand in that kind of balanced perspective, that open perspective, just noticing what that might feel like. And then in the same way, what does it mean to stand in that center place of a sense of rootedness and perspective when pleasure or pain arises without getting pulled into needing or seeking or having to have pleasure, without getting pulled into the fear and the avoidance and the rejection of the natural experience of pain. And what would that be to stand in the middle of gain and loss, being able to see the naturalness of the flow of the inevitability of gain and loss, the constant cycling of these different experiences? What would it mean to stand rooted with, again, success and failure, without your identity being totally built, your self-worth built on that? And what allows you to do that is having very clear intention about what's most important. It's about being very clear about your spiritual purpose. It's also about learning to take refuge, to understand, to rest in your deeper nature, to find contact, to know what that means, to practice your meditation so that you begin to find the underlying silence and stillness and peace that is actually your true nature. It's beginning to be able to see the comings and goings, the impermanence, the fleeting nature, the ephemeral, dreamlike, trance-like reality, and begin to rest in something that's actually deeper and truer. And as I said, it doesn't mean you stop feeling. Actually, my experience is you feel more clearly, you feel more passionately, you feel more authentic, you feel more aligned with what's true. And all that other stuff, that moving towards this, avoiding that, going here, grabbing, is actually completely obscuring something more available, more nurturing, more profound that's here all the time. So, our practice is to become mindful of these eight worldly conditions, to see the pattern of them, to know the consequence, to investigate them. Our practice is to develop mindful and skillful responses. Our practice is to know again and again our deepest intentions and come back to them with unfailing regularity. One of my favorite quotes is from Suzuki Roshi: the most important thing is to remember the most important thing. And if you do that again and again throughout the day, that's what will enliven your spiritual journey and transformation and opening. And lastly, the practice is learning to fully rest and open and trust in this deeper way of being, deeper way of knowing, that is our innate reality. Something far more sustaining than all this other stuff and this coming and going and the ups and downs. And then it becomes much more possible to meet it with compassion, to actually meet it with joy, to begin to dance with the ups and downs instead of being slapped around by the ups and downs. So we have very few minutes, but we have a few minutes. I appreciate the comments you are added through my questions, but I just wondered if there's any last few comments or additions or questions about this investigation. I have to come back for that, Dharma. No, it depends on how you use the word shame. Shame is used in a certain way in the traditional translations of Buddhist teachings, which I think of as more as appropriate remorse, and that's extremely important. But often the way I use shame, and shame is used in our culture, is something else altogether. It's really a very deep sense of being flawed and inadequate. And that's the shame that is problematic and extremely widespread, almost in our culture, extremely widespread. So, yeah, it's important to make distinguish that. Yeah. I just heard a story today where Bill Clinton was, I think, in Europe or something, and some young protesters threw eggs at him. And his comment was, well, young people should get angry at times. So that was a cool response. Yeah, I mean, there's wonderful possibilities for creativity and openness and connection when we stand rooted in the wisdom and insight when all that other stuff is going. So, well, you have to practice for it anyway. Yeah, it would be kind of fun to keep going with, let's see how many metaphors out of sailing we could get. It's actually quite relevant.
It's rich.
And, you know, one of the things is that, you know, it really helps you respect that the forces are bigger than you and it's not personal. Because, again, all these eight worldly winds we tend to take very personally. And we begin to, and part of the teaching is that it's not personal. It happens to everyone over and over and over again. And that's actually a big contribution to equanimity. And also compassion to begin to recognize everybody else is going through this too, even if we're not saying it. So every other sailor is going through that as well. All right. So thank you for listening. I hope there was something useful in this talk that you will take with you and investigate more. Pema Chodron's one of the better teachers on Eight Worldly Winds. There's a nice chapter about it in her book, When Things Fall Apart. You can find other things as well. So I'll just do a little dedication and we'll be done for the evening. So please take a moment to breathe, to settle in your seat, to find your root right here and now, to take your seat, to be the mountain that is able to be present with all the winds and the storms and the beautiful weather and the sky and the sunsets and everything else. And may we do this practice so that we may find the deep freedom and love in our own hearts, and we may become beacons and helpers to all beings everywhere.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.